We all run into words we haven't heard before, and when they don't actually make sense, we put them in a category of gibberish, gobbledygook, word salad. Gibberish has a long history, from made-up languages in 12th century Germany all the way to scat singing in jazz music. But sometimes people use that gibberish label to describe and even demean words used by people from cultures that are different from their own. Jenny Nuttle is a lecturer in medieval English literature at Exeter College in the University of Oxford. She recently wrote a piece about the history of gibberish for Eon. Jenny, thanks for joining us.
Hi, how are you?
Good, good. Thanks for breaking this down for us. You write that people who study language love to track down the origins of words. So we should start with the word gibberish. Where does it come from?
Well, it's just got 100 years older because it was originally thought that it came into English in the 16th century, and the lexicographers at the Middle English Dictionary have found an example from the middle of the 15th century. We're not sure, it's one of those words that has a kind of mysterious origin, but we think it might come from verbs that we find slightly later, like gobble and gabber and jabber and gab. So if you think of England having the language of English, gibber has the language of gibberish, or those who gibber speak gibberish. So it's a kind of imitation of what hearing someone talking nonsense, unintelligible sound might be.
And that is how we use it now. Has it always meant the same thing?
Not really. And I got interested in it now because it's used so often as a kind of pejorative, but it's used now, I think, to mean language which does actually make sense, although it might be difficult or slightly incoherent. But it's used now to mean language that we don't like for some reason. We think it's too technical, or we think the person doesn't know what they're talking about. Back in its earliest meaning, it does literally mean its more precise meaning, which is language that you just cannot understand. And in the first example of the word gibberish in English, it's used to describe what it's like if you kind of say your prayers without paying attention, if you mumble your prayers under your breath. And the author says, well, that's like talking gibberish to God, and goes on to say it's like talking a mixture of English and French, which were the two languages commonly spoken in medieval England. It's like a kind of impossible mixture of those two things. So I think the older meaning is more accurate, and nowadays we tend to fling it around to put other groups down, as you were saying.
Sure. So I don't like what someone else is saying, or I don't think that their point is valid. So that's when I slap the label of gibberish on it and just say, well, that doesn't make any sense. More in a theoretical aspect instead of with the precision of where the word came from.
Yes, I think that's right.
You write that there's this issue in there about who is who, what gibberish is, depending on what is considered mainstream culture and who's an outsider. How does that play out in the way that we talk about people not making sense?
Yes, and I think you find gibberish, particularly in the 16th century, connected with groups of immigrants into England, with the Romani, for example, the gypsy culture, also in expressions like double Dutch, which is a way of saying that you can't understand what someone's saying. And you find it as a label for people speaking their own language, again, language that makes perfect sense, but perhaps in a cultural context where it's not understood. And that connection between outsiders and the language they speak goes all the way back into that word barbarian, barbarous, which was explained in Greek as imitating the sound that people who didn't speak Greek, who spoke other languages, made. So they made sounds like animals, like sheep, perhaps, bar, bar, bar. So we've always used ideas of talking gibberish and words that can kind of imitate how the sound of the speaker of another language sounds to us, to kind of notice that difference. And in the Renaissance, particularly in the theatre, there's lots of references to it's all Greek to me, it's double Dutch, double Hebrew, talking Welsh. The English always seem very aware of other languages they're hearing that they find funny or difficult.
Right. And labeling them other, because we also use gobbledygook words like that to describe maybe different words that people who are experts use, or different professions or social classes. We categorize them like this.
Yes. And I mean, a word like jargon has an interesting history. It starts off as a French word for birdsong, actually, but then becomes a way of describing kind of people chattering very fast, people using technical terms. It becomes a word for slang. And now jargon, I think, like gobbledygook, like gibberish, serves this function of being able to say, I don't understand it. And rather than sort of acknowledging that you don't understand something or you don't like it, there's a useful label. But what I'm really interested in is it's often not literally gibberish. Gibberish in its pure form is not words at all, just kind of representations on the page of sounds and things that look like words. And most of the time, gibberish, jargon, slang is perfectly functioning language to someone's ear. It's just we choose not to see it that way.
Jenny Nuttall is a lecturer in medieval English literature at Exeter College at the University of Oxford. And we're talking about gibberish, nonsensical language, and what we really mean when we say that. Jenny, there are some instances, though, right, of people intentionally making up words that just don't make a lot of sense.
Yes, and that has a really long history in English. So if you go back to Old English, the language spoken in England before the Norman Conquest, you find medical remedies. They're a sort of cross between a treatment and a spell. And some of these remedies, they were written or copied down in about the year 1000. And some of them have words from foreign languages, Latin or Hebrew. But some of them have little stretches of absolute pure gibberish. And scholars study them, but can't make any sense of it. And what we've gradually realized is that they're gibberish but used in a kind of positive, beneficial way, perhaps like a packet of pills with a really fancy name that you don't understand. And if you said one of these old charms to yourself with the gibberish word, you would feel like the words were doing you good. So I think gibberish does have a kind of potentially kind of healing, playful, reassuring capacity. We sing gibberish quite a lot when we're happy, kind of folk songs, and you know, when we're improvising, and we often use kind of gibberish sounds when we're singing and playing with babies and children. So I'm interested in what is actually real gibberish, not the kind of the language we label as gibberish, but the real gibberish that seems to want to break through in the world around us in all sorts of interesting ways.
Well, and one of the most obvious examples of that is in music when it comes to jazz. How should we think about how gibberish is worked into music?
Well, it has an interesting name. They're called non-lexical vocables. And you could think of it emerging perhaps when the human voice is imitating an instrument and improvising alongside other instruments. And it's easier perhaps to do that not using the lyrics of a song, but the kind of using the voice as a musical instrument. And that has a long tradition. You find these non-lexical vocables, these sung sounds, which are not conventional words, in folk singing and all the way back through Tudor songs with Hey Nonny Nonny and Hey Trolley Lolly, and all the way back into medieval carols and lullabies.
What about what drives us to make up words that don't have full languages, that don't have decipherable meanings? Where does that come from?
Oh God, I mean, you find gibberish in so many different places. I mean, sometimes it can be useful. We can test children's in Britain. Children get their reading ability, their ability to decode phonetics at an early age tested by being given gibberish words, and the teachers tell them that they're the names of aliens, and please can the kids read the names of aliens. I think it's always the kind of other side of the coin of our language ability in a way. We spend such a lot of time as babies and children and then adults making sense. But that in some ways is a kind of conscious decision, because we know playfully or usefully we can turn off the making sense bit of our language and just enjoy the sounds, whether it's singing or play, or it can be high art, it can be kind of sound poetry, modernist sound poetry. It's because it gives us our language in some sense. It's always there for us to use if we want to.
And then we can take those sounds, and sometimes, you know, is there potential that they become real words that we use and that eventually carry meaning?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think some of those words, so, you know, the words that are half gibberish in a poem like Lewis Carroll's The Jabberwocky have become kind of almost words. And I think there are particularly onomatopoeic words where we're imitating sound in language, you know, whoosh or mush or those kind of words. Those start off as kind of imitative sounds and then eventually find their way into the dictionary. And a word like lullaby, those two parts of the word lullaby are made from two sounds that you find in medieval carols that describe how the Virgin Mary sang to the infant Christ, and she sings in the medieval carols words or non-lexical vocables like lula and bye-bye, the sort of noises you might sing to a baby, and that becomes our word lullaby.
Yeah. Jenny, thank you so much for breaking this down for us.
Thank you.
Jenny Nuttall is a lecturer in medieval English literature at Exeter College at the University of Oxford. You're listening to Central Time.